another Monday, another Talk About That, another series of delightful and informative conversations.
I think it's cool to be coming out on Monday because Monday's like traditionally a tough day, right?
Yeah.
You're starting the slog of your week.
Ooh, slog. That's a nice...
And we give you that little boost that you need.
Yeah.
I've not had a normal week in a long time. Like, I've been doing comedy full-time since 2012. And so then your weeks get thrown out. Like, you know, a Monday is my first day off of the week usually. Like, I'm getting home. So a Monday feels like a weekend to me. And then the last year and a half of my life has been like, what day is it?
Right.
I don't know what day it is. But I'm sure, like, for people who have just worked through everything, they're just like, yeah, Monday's like a case of the Mondays. And we're trying to help. We want to help.
Monday always feels good to me just because it's the day after Sunday. I mean, I don't dislike Sundays, but that's my big work day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess every day is a big work day. Johnny, how do you feel about Sabbath?
Like, in general?
Yeah, like, do you think, I do believe.
I don't think we observe it.
Yeah,
really.
Well, that's true. Like, I really do believe that humans are made to rest 1/7 of their life, and I don't come anywhere close to that.
Well, if you count sleeping, we rest 1/3 of our life. Did
no.
I just blow your mind with math?
I think waking time.
Oh, waking rest.
Yeah. Like, a time when you're not engaged, it's not up to you.
I think there's a lot you don't know about me.
You're like, I Sabbath a lot. I am meeting all of God's principles.
No, I don't know. It's, yeah. I think that that's the whole thing about there's a lot of workaholics in this country and everywhere probably. We're just raised to be like achievers. So it feels like we're going against our achievement mentality, or we're becoming lazy. Like I was raised to, like, that's the worst thing you could say about somebody is that they were lazy.
Yeah.
Or crazy. Crazy and lazy are like the most dismissive things you can say.
Reminds me of a song I wrote. Johnny, that was a horrible song, but it was really cool music.
It was. I don't know.
I liked the music.
Man.
It was all E chords up and down the entire.
Yeah, we just.
Because I had learned, you had taught me.
Yeah.
You could dug this E chord up. I was like, I'm going to write a song. And I did. And we recorded it.
Mm-hmm. Johnny, it was called Crazy.
Did you know? I think this is.
It's like a Dr. Seuss Crazy, Lazy, Hazy.
Yes. They were horrible. Well, they rhymed.
Jay-Z wasn't rapping yet, or he would have been in
it. Oh, my goodness. You knew how bad I was.
It's like, I wonder if Manic Monday was written today, the Bangles Manic Monday,
right.
If it would definitely have the word Hyundai in it, right? You ever think about that? Like, what songs would have pop culture references differently?
Well, my least favorite song of, it drives Laura crazy because she loves it. One of my least favorite songs is You Have to Let It Linger, the Cranberries.
Oh, yeah.
It's all, like, we said the word finger.
Yeah.
So now we have to say linger. Do you have to? I'm like, oh my gosh, how did this song make it?
Yeah.
And it's horrible. It sounds like, again, I don't mean to be crude.
It's a big hit, John.
I think you're
a
middle schooler.
You're besmirching a gigantic hit.
You know, I use the word besmirch yesterday.
I think that singer died this past year, too.
Well, I'm not besmirching her character. I was a horrible songwriter, but none of mine ever
Maybe
took
she's
off.
A zombie. I'm sorry. That was another Cranberry song.
Oh my goodness.
No, but yeah, that's a good song. It's just, you don't like the...
I don't like it.
No one says, do you have to let it linger, when they're referring to, like, I don't know. Like,
anything.
It's just a stretch to say,
it's the
hey,
hook.
In our relationship, do you have to let it linger? Like, no one says,
no.
It's a very, I wrote this line because it rhymes with finger.
Yes, it's so evident to me that that's what happened, because as a bad songwriter, I recognize these things. If I knew how to write good songs, I would have.
Yeah.
So I know the patterns
like
of bad
finger,
songs.
Like you could put,
oh,
like a dinger, like baseball, like a home run is sometimes called a dinger. Like if you're in love with a baseball player, the thing writes itself.
Oh,
no.
My goodness, that
would. Did you
been...
have to hit a dinger? I don't know. Did you have to? Did you have to?
Did you have to?
It's about Barry Bonds.
Verses are all about steroids.
Steroids are lingering. Not long though, man. He lost a bunch of weight when he retired. That's the thing, when you say never use drugs, and then the minute you retire, you look like Jimmy Walker. You know what I'm saying? Like Urkel. Like he lost like 60 pounds in his head. You know, you're like, I think you might have been lying about that.
Hey, those steroids went straight to his head.
They did.
That guy, this success.
He's like Barry Bonds on steroids.
That's my favorite. Yeah. Every time I take steroids for like a,
right.
a cold or whatever, I use your joke.
I used to have a joke about it. I was really nervous about trying steroids, but Lance Armstrong assured me, it's just like riding a bike. I remember I told that joke in Austin one time, and it did not go over well. Because it was in the middle of like, maybe we believe him, maybe we don't.
Yeah.
Still. Like, then he came out and was like, hey, I cheated. But before that, I was just like making jokes about it.
Oh, man.
And he's from Austin. That's where he's based. And so yep. I was like, I didn't know what I was doing. I was just like, huh, where am I at? I'll do my Whataburger joke here. And my, you know, and then I just did my
Hey, speaking of Armstrong we're joke. Getting a Whataburger.
I've heard. People are very excited about burger chains, and I just don't get it. Burgers, I mean, how many ways can you do a burger? Burgers are good. I don't know. I like a McDonald's double cheeseburger.
Yeah.
I'm easy.
Yeah, but it's hard. Listen.
Like, I think it's about scarcity. Like, Aaron Weber, who's a comedian friend, he talked about this, about how In-N-Out is like people vault it to the moon. If you live in the South, like, go out west, oh, you got to try In-N-Out. You go to Texas, I got to try In-N-Out. And they talk about it like it's this religious experience, but it's about scarcity. Like, if he said his hypothesis is that if there were less McDonald's, you'd be like, dude, you got to try the Big Mac.
Yeah.
You know?
No, that is true, because In-N-Out, the first time I had it was in Dallas, and I was like, well, this is
a very good burger.
It's good.
The fries are a little ordinary.
But be honest with you, I had to believe all these things are tied to memory.
Yeah.
And especially to childhood memories, if you have any of them. But
if you have any of them, you know, I've blocked them all out.
I didn't mean like
sorry to those of you who.
I didn't mean in general.
If you have any.
I just meant like, you know, McDonald's is still special to me because it was a treat when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, and I, by the way, the food that built America, they just did this part of the history of McDonald's when, in order to counteract, it was they were counteracting the chicken sandwich. So Burger King made the
That's
first.
That's still going on. That's so funny. Yeah. There was chicken wars even then.
Yep. The first chicken sandwich came out. It was right when, like in the late 70s, the U.S. Department of Health started saying, hey, you know, high saturated fats, all these kinds of things are bad for you. And so their answer was they started eating fried chicken. Mm-hmm. Like they're not knowing.
Not grilled yet.
Right. They're not even grilling it. And Burger King, it was like a huge coup.
But it's still not red meat. Maybe it is better for, I don't know if it's better for you.
Well,
than red
in the
meat.
Market, it was a huge coup. Yeah. You're still getting French fries.
It
and
was a
Coke.
It was a cuckoo. It was a bacar. Okay.
And so they literally couldn't find an answer to it.
Yeah.
They didn't want to make a chicken sandwich. And so Ray Kroc has them, I mean, he hired this gourmet chef.
Uh-huh.
Brought him on and was like, I want you to figure out. And so the process that brought chicken nuggets about, which changed the whole world, was like several years. Like he was making pot pies. He was trying all kinds of things. And he is a literal, like, he had been the chef to Queen Elizabeth.
Oh,
and all of, like, I'm talking a world-renowned chef, worked for McDonald's for several years in, like, development. And he came up. He had deep fried. One of the VPs was walking through, and it was all this stuff. And Kroc was horrible to work for, and everybody couldn't stand him. He was super hard on everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the
have
guys,
you seen the founder?
I've not actually seen
you
it.
You need
yet.
To. It's really good.
And he came through, and he had what did he deep fried? He had these little things, and he had deep fried
a shoe.
No, it was a vegetable or something of some sort.
Yeah.
And the guy didn't like it, but the guy goes, "Could you do this with chicken?" And so the first time. Because chicken was labor intensive, deboning it and all that. It was the first time anyone had figured out, like, oh, okay, we can basically
make this into a mash.
Right, reconstitute chicken in our own image, you know? And so, yeah, and they went through the whole process. And chicken nuggets then was the answer to Burger King's chicken sandwich. And it completely, they sell more nuggets than they do burgers.
It's,
you know?
The funniest part of that is when you said McDonald's was a treat when you were a kid, because now I feel like it's the go-to for parents who are just like, I didn't make a plan.
No, it wasn't.
I bet you there's families that their kids get McDonald's five times a week.
I am one of those families.
I am too.
when we're on the road to volleyball or whatever, we just don't have.
Dude, I mean, a Diet Coke just from the pump at McDonald's. It's the best. It's the best Diet Coke.
It is
that you can get. I don't know what it is about their Diet Coke, and I'm sure their regular Coke is like, you know, great too. But I'm saying like their Diet Coke, there's something about it from the McDonald's pump. It's so good.
Well, that was the reason we started this whole thing. It was a treat, but it was regular. I don't know.
You just regularly got treats.
I just regularly
just
got
like
treats.
Just like my dogs.
Yeah.
But every time my dogs come inside from outside, they look at the counter where I keep the little bag of pepperoni. I have these little strips, little Slim Jims. And they think that that's their reward just for coming in from outside every time. Like, I give them one a day. The first time they go out in the morning,
yeah,
and they come back in, I give them that. But now, every time they come in, they're just like, they look at that counter and they look at the bag like, all right,
yep,
we did our job.
Yep. So, well, Ace, if I've called him and he comes in, I give him a treat every time, and it's worth it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So, but if he just comes on his own, he doesn't. And I tell him as such.
It's too late to train my dogs. They're crazy. They do what they want.
Well,
they run the roost.
Talk about training. So mm-hmm. That's the other big thing McDonald's did.
Talk about training.
Talk
the new
about
podcast
training.
From the creators of...
is the Happy Meal.
Yeah.
That's the other thing that put them completely...
Sure.
And it did. It back to our original idea.
Something to choke on for the kids.
Well,
beautiful.
It literally trained kids. Now you... I do believe our obsession with McDonald's is tied to that great little box with that worthless toy.
It had the little, like, you could do doodles on the back with a little, it had a little maze and little fun facts about things.
Yep.
And,
yeah. And immediately captured multiple generations now. So I don't necessarily want to go to McDonald's, but every time there is something about it that I'm reliving, you know, there's something
it's a touchstone.
Special. Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's powerful. Yep. That's the reason, like, I used to do parodies in my show, and I started, like, not liking them as much. They're a lot of hassle. We've talked about that before, about how you're supposed to get all these weird,
right,
like, you're supposed to pay residuals, or you're supposed to record your own original version, which that's one end around.
Yeah.
But you're protected by satire laws, technically, to do a parody and then monetize it, but it's a very, like, gray area. And I always felt weird about it. But beyond that, I just didn't want to be like, you'll be the Christian Weird Al. Like,
right.
I just kept hearing that. And I was like, I don't want to, I want to be myself.
Right.
And so I started, like, being more attracted to doing, like, parodies of, like, genres of songs and writing my own original stuff.
Right.
And it'll be short little, like, pull the carpet out, you know, at mm-hmm. the end of the song kind of little bits. And that's what I do now in my show. But the thing about a parody that's so powerful that you really can't get from another thing is that touchstone moment, because they're connecting to that song that
right.
they grew up with or that they know the tune to. And then when you add your funny lyrics over the top, it's like, it's always a win, unless you're just really bad at it.
Yeah.
It's like this, it's like, it'd be like playing baseball and you start on second base.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what it's like. When you walk out, like I used to walk out to a Kings of Leon song that was my opener. And it was a very recognizable song. And the minute I hit the first note and I can actually sing and they have a song they recognize, it's a double right then.
Yep.
All I got to do now is like find my way home. Mm-hmm. And so, whereas when you start with a regular song, you're just like, all right, I'm just trying to lay down a hit here.
Yeah.
We're back to baseball. I don't know how. But
wow.
I know a lot about baseball, John. You know that.
Speaking of, by the way, University of Tennessee is in the College World Series.
I heard.
First time in like
that's it.
Are
they still doing
years?
That in Omaha?
Omaha. So
that's
imagine.
Like, that whole town's built around that stadium and that culture. I'm glad it's back because they didn't have it last year, right? They had to cancel it for COVID.
No, I don't know where they played. Vanderbilt won it last year.
Oh, okay. I didn't think they even played it.
But, you know, you can imagine Peyton Manning, because, you know, his call
right. Omaha.
Is Omaha. So all the videos right now and him with the baseball team, because he loves it. Anytime a Tennessee team of any sort is doing well,
that's funny.
Peyton flies in and he's such an ambassador for the university still, you know. But the Omaha stuff is hilarious. But
how many people named their kids, girl or boy, Peyton?
Oh, I know people.
Because of that guy. Like, I've met some Kobes mm-hmm. in the last few years.
Yep.
But... there's a lot of Peytons in Tennessee and Indianapolis and, you know, Indiana.
Neyland's another name.
Oh, is it really?
People use. Yeah, I know multiple Neylands. Neyland, Peyton. Not any Fulmers. I haven't seen that. So, but
no Fulmers, did you say?
Yeah. I haven't heard anybody named Fulmer. I'm trying to think of what...
Fulmer,
what...
get over here. They're like their dog. Like if you had a big
dog.
Fulmer, get in here.
We realize that we landed on the perfect name for our dog now. Like, you know, Ace, because of volleyball...
Yeah.
It has a volleyball connection because it's Sadie's dog.
Right.
And then...
Ace is like a perfect serve, right? Unreturned serve.
Right. It's like you score on the serve without
right.
the minute. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it also, it has, I can put it into a Latin form. So it has a long name. It's really important to me
this
for my dogs.
This is really dumb.
Ignatius.
This is getting...
You know what I'm saying? So that's his... That's
you
his,
say Ignatius to him?
Occasionally, yeah. Like he has...
This is ridiculous.
He has a name that's, you know, this is his nickname.
We've talked about... There's actually a TikTok phenomenon where they'll say, what's the name of your dog and what are the other names that you call him that aren't his name? And then people will use the like little Siri voice to say the names. It's kind of a funny thing. And they'll have the dog in the shot.
Yeah.
And they're reading these list of names. And you said yours for like Brutus was like Brutai and Brutimaeus.
Brutie, yeah. Brookie. It had all kinds of stuff.
And it made me think like I have some for Toby. Like I say, you know, I walk in every time when they're there. I go, well, look who it is. I always say, well, look who it is.
They think that's their name.
Poots McGillicuddy. That's one. Poots McGillicuddy. Shaggy McGee. Sometimes I'll say something, some version of their name. Like, we're trying to get Toby to jump in the bed at night because, like, he'll wait on the floor. It's dark, and we can't go to sleep until he gets, because he's clicking around on the floor. Yeah. We have hardwood. So we're like, get in the bed, Toby. Toby! Toby! And then Curry will start in. I'll be like, Toby, Toblerone! Steven Tobolowski! Tobu! Tobias! And then we just go through the whole thing. And then finally, I've settled on morbid Tobesity. So he usually gets in the bed for that.
He does that one.
It's like a half insult. I'm nagging him a little bit.
Right. You shame him into the bed.
So it's morbid Tobesity. And then my other chubby dog is type 2 Daisybeetes because she's Daisy. So
that's great. That's great. Yeah, we call him, for some reason, he gets called Bubba a lot.
Oh.
And
Ace
that,
is called Bubba?
Yeah.
He's not a Bubba dog. That's a little dog.
I can't help it. I don't know how it happened.
All right,
whatever. And then that turns into Bubby. You know, it just gets his, I don't know, it just adapts the more he does stuff. But the name of your dog, yeah, it's important. I don't think anyone calls their dog, I mean, unless there's like a hunting dog or whatever.
Right, then you need like to establish that.
No, my dog's
but if you're just being playful, you end up with all these weird, they're literal pet names. They're pet names for your pet.
Pet names, yeah. I like it that it's a name, though, again, that has multiple meanings. That's important, Johnny.
Ignatius. What's wrong with you? From the Greek, I believe it means. Remember those bookmarks you would get in the Christian bookstore that would have your name and what it meant?
Yeah.
And it would always be, like, I always had this dark, like, feeling, like, I wanted someone's name to mean, like, you know, enemy of God, you know, just to see the kid's face, like, fall. Because they always been, like,
Come here, Damien.
Yeah, like, sent from above. They always said, like, gift from God or chosen, you know. And then I just wanted one kid to be like, what does Claire mean? And they look at it and it's like, you know.
Destined for hell.
It means purgatory. What in the world? Like,
well, you know, Sarah means bitter, but it, but it also means, I think, princess. So it's like whichever
you choose the one that's a little bit on the.
If you have
we're not going to sell a lot of these bookmarks, Bob. This means bitter.
Oh, that's funny.
It would be great, though. We need to make our own line of Christian name bookmark, especially with all these new names. They're not in the Bible.
Yeah.
So we could say, like, we've taken this. We could lie, but we just say, we've taken Skylar and Bryce and all these other new names. Tanner.
Research the closest.
And we've researched the closest, you know, Hebrew origins. And what we've come up with is, you know.
Let's just make weird stuff.
Murderer. So good luck, Skylar. You know.
It's weird things like it means dog walker somehow.
Right.
Like, you know, it has like
it means a vocational school. What do you think about that?
It's weird. And the rudimentary translations are wow. You really that's funny.
We should, though. That's a market that's untapped.
It's true.
Although Christian bookstores are all like gone, so it'd have to be like a website thing.
Correct. I told you the story of that almost got my first book deal. And it was like in motion. They were working out the contract.
Right as Zondervan and all that goes
and
down.
And then it was a denominational house, and they were going to give me 3 books.
Yeah.
And then like the day or two before I thought I'd hear back from them, they're like, hey, we just shut down all of our bookstores, so no.
Man, that's brutal, right?
I was like, oh, man.
It's like our producer, Travis Wyrick, who's won many Dove Awards, but back in the day, he was in a group called Sage, and they were like this local phenomenon in Knoxville and in East Tennessee. They were traveling, they were touring, they opened for Bon Jovi, they did some cool things.
Yeah.
And they were just like a, I don't know what you would call them, like glam rock band in the era of that. It was like 1989. They started probably 86, 87. So they're right in the wave of like the Motley Crues and the Bon Jovis and the hair bands.
Yeah.
And they're really good, and they're starting to get, like, some traction. And they were scheduled to meet with Sony and sign a deal. And then literally, like, Travis told me, like, a month before their meeting.
Like, grunge took
off. They get this call, and the guy says, we're sending all of our executives to Seattle.
Wow.
And because there's this whole grunge thing, we're like taking a total, the industry's going a different direction. So we're holding all acquisitions right now of any other style of music. And so it's like he just missed his window.
Wow.
Because of the timing. It's really, yeah. It got to be strange. It's like rapcore was a thing in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like, what do you do? And what you do is just the whole world changes overnight. And you're just like, you're Limp Bizkit.
Yeah.
And the world decides that's not cool anymore. And you're like, this is what I do. Yeah. I rap over electric guitars.
What did...
You shouldn't be doing that.
Didn't
is what the
Kid Rock find a way to transition?
Well, he did the whole like, I'm a country trailer trash guy. Even though it's funny, he's from Detroit.
Right.
Like, and he's from a really wealthy suburb in Detroit.
I mean, he was that rock core
I'm not like hating on Kid Rock, core. Although whatever, Kid Rock's...
But he was rap core at one point, right?
And then, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then suddenly he's... Does he do country music? This is how disconnected from country music I am.
I think what he does now is kind of nostalgia because his shows are like, he plays the hits.
But
so he'll
see
do the
Ba
with the Ba, and he'll also do his like Sheryl Crow country song that he did with her. Remember that duet?
Oh, I'll see him so open for country artists all the time. I'm
right.
Like, what kind of music is he doing?
I don't know what it is, but he somehow got into that world because he's like, I wear a white tank top and a...
Right. It's like he tried to tap into Americana.
Yeah, right.
From
and he plays a little guitar, but yeah, he's kind of
like
he kind of talks, sings. I don't know.
I think I see him at the Grand Ole Opry side
right.
when I go by. I'm like, what is Kid Rock doing?
Yeah.
At the Grand Ole Opry,
he's there, and I think it's like when you cross pollinate and you have a lot of friends in that industry. People are like, wouldn't it be wild if Kid Rock did a song, and then it just worked for some reason.
I mean, I guess that was his lifeboat away from that other genre. I mean,
yeah.
Man, surely had enough
But I'm
money.
Telling you, he probably still does shows and does those old like hits that are rapcore, and the crowd loves him because again, it's Touchstone. It's your if you grew up with that,
yeah.
You're not going to make new fans with that music.
Well, it's Darius Rucker doing Hootie songs at his shows.
Yeah, which I wonder how he does that. Unless there's some agreement with the group, or maybe he wrote them and so they're his property.
I would go because I want to hear the Hootie songs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what if you get there and he just does all of his country hits, then you're
like, boo! You know, and it's
boo!
Like, I mean, he's a big deal in country music, but I just don't.
He is.
Maybe his music.
That's
good.
Another guy who got, like, he made it twice.
Yeah.
He started over and made it twice.
Oh, my goodness.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
Green Day kind of did that. Like, they had their big, huge splash, then they went away, then they did, like, a Broadway musical.
Yeah.
And then they did, like, two more huge records.
I'm not a Green Day fan.
Well, I'm just telling you, they did it, John. You don't have to be their fan.
I'm not a
to
fan.
Acknowledge their
I
impact
want to be
on
known.
Society.
And I love that kind of music, but I can't handle his voice. He's not screaming. He's like up in his head voice yelling at you the whole time. When I come out. It's like there's one.
What was that? It was a
When I Come Around.
Yeah.
But like he's doing it though in the verses the same way. It's like the whole time.
Yeah.
There's no differentiation of dynamic. Like I need a dynamic shift. I want you to go away so I can miss you. You know what I'm saying?
How dare you, John?
Oh my! They're never gonna make it. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking about this at lunch, but like movies and shows that come out, we've grown up with this, but it wasn't always this way. Somewhere in our childhood, it became commonplace to see, like, the weekend numbers from a movie.
Uh-huh.
That was not, like, when I was a little kid, that was not true. Like, Superman 3 would come out, and you'd just be like, it was good, it was bad. You might read a couple of reviews, and then you'd just be like, yeah, I went. Or this may go like, no, I didn't see it.
Yeah.
Now it's like, you know right away, like, you can tank a movie by hearing the numbers of how it did the first weekend. If Fast and Furious 9 or whatever is coming out this weekend, it's expected to be like the big bounce back movie from movies, like theaters, because they've been in the doldrums mm-hmm. because nobody's going to theaters. But now they've held these releases of some of these blockbusters summer. And now they're like, this will be the one that brings everybody back. But if it doesn't, like we're going to know and it could affect, like you could
it
go,
could affect
oh,
the
that
perception
only did,
of
that
the
only
quality
did 20
movie,
million.
Right.
That only did 20 million. I would stay home.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a relatively new thing. It's only a couple of three decades old, maybe.
But I wonder if because it doesn't do as well, it doesn't stay in the theater as long.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder if it's a chicken and the egg kind of thing.
I don't know, but it's like the thing that's fascinating to me about it, and we talk about the music thing too, if something is popular and you like it, it becomes this thing of like, I liked it. And that became a thing in the 90s and 2000s too, like emo. where, or like underground, where an artist would get big that you've liked forever and you would turn your back on them because now they've changed.
Yeah.
But for the most part, in the beginning, you were rooting. You're like, yeah, finally someone else discovered this great thing. But I think with movies, it's like, if you like something and then it becomes a hit, it confirms that you have good taste. And that's the most important thing to a consumer, is to feel like we have our finger on the pulse.
Right.
Like Mission Impossible 3 was good. I told y'all. And then it makes $150 million. You're like, see?
Yeah.
I'm amazing. It has nothing to do with you, but somehow you take a little bit of like a credit from it.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I just really do feel that. That like if a band has a huge whirlwind tour and you go, yeah, I was there. I was there in St. Louis when they did the blah, 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 and it was amazing. You're talking about your moment. It's not really even about the band anymore.
Yeah.
I even think when I book shows, when I used to think that about my calendar. I was like, no one cares whether or not I have a show at their venue or their church or whatever I do. What they care about is what they're picturing in their head when they book me is the Monday after in the staff meeting with everybody giving them the attaboy, that what a great event that was. And they want that win. They may want an event for their church too, but I'm saying like if they're the booker and they're putting their neck out there for me,
yeah,
they're picturing that moment where they're validated from choosing me. And I want to give them that win.
Interesting.
Because I'm picturing that moment too. I'm picturing in my head, this guy's going to get gang tackled the Monday morning because he brought me in because it was such a home run.
See,
again, baseball.
I think that you get gang tackled in baseball.
I'm sure. Yeah, if you win the World Series, they rush the mound.
No, that's the wrong sport, Johnny.
Yeah.
That's football. I'm really thinking you're going to roll your eyes, but don't. I think you're coming around a little bit.
Is this going to be an Enneagram?
Well, I think you're assuming something about all consumers that, yeah, I think is going through a lens of yourself.
No, and I'm open to that. I'm saying this is what I feel. Or do you think this is true?
No, I think my wife, who's a two, if she was in charge of putting on the event, it really would be about the experience of everyone who came.
Yeah.
She would care more about that than about, because you and I think, you're a six, I think, or a seven with a strong six wing, that what we fear is being targeted or blamed.
Yeah.
And so we also then desire the opposite of that. We desire to be as loyal as important to the organization and to bring wins.
Yeah.
So yes, when we do it, I'd always think, what good did this do or bad did this do? And was I blamed for it, or was I responsible for its good in the overall narrative of this organization? Like I think very big like that, you know, and that's why we talk about whether we're an event church now or not an event church, because it's all about how it plays into the bigger picture. While again, my wife will literally think of things if we have someone over or whatever in terms of its success was what, not even how did they like it. That's not even her highest success. In an unhealthy place it can be, but generally for her, she's pretty healthy on this. It is just I wanted them to enjoy this.
Yeah.
Like she's so other centered.
But that's what I'm saying. That is success for a comedy event. If you look out there and people are laughing.
Yeah, both will happen. It's just different motivations for what you got.
Yeah, and I don't think it's 100% one side or the other, no matter where you fall on the spectrum. But I do think about merch too. Like when I started talking to people about, like, I wanted to do a t-shirt. And I was like, should I put one of my jokes on the t-shirt? The first t-shirt I did was my joke about people who don't believe in autocorrect go straight to heel. And I put a little iPhone. I had my buddy Brett design this iPhone design, and he put it on the iPhone in a cool text. We started selling them at some of these shows. And I was touring with Tim Hawkins quite a bit then, so I was getting in front of big crowds. And it was funny, and it would sell a certain amount. And then I got one that said, I don't speak Latin per se. It sold less. It was very like an inside, it's kind of a...
Probably my favorite joke of yours.
Right,
of
I love
time.
It. It's like a cerebral thing. And the people that loved it, loved it.
Ignatius
loves it. It sold like 1/10 of what the autocorrect sold.
Yeah.
So I'd take them out sometimes. Sometimes I wouldn't. And then my buddy Marty was selling this shirt that said, it just said, my love language is sarcasm. It's just a very, like, it's not even a joke. It's just like this thing. And they would just fly. And I was like, dude. And so I started licensing those shirts from him and taking them out with me. And I've probably sold I've sold several thousand of those shirts.
Wow.
And what I've come to realize is, like, people, if you sell a piece of merch at a show, and I always tell other comedians this, if you are selling a shirt that makes you look clever, like, as a comedian, like, they'll love this clever joke I wrote,
mm-hmm.
you're already kind of in the wrong headspace. because when somebody's buying a shirt, what they're picturing in my mind is, and I've asked people about this too, they're picturing themselves being seen as funny by wearing it.
Yep.
So if you don't already have that, don't make 100 of those shirts. They'll be in your garage. Like, people buy that. Whenever people buy the sarcasm shirt, it's always somebody going, people say this about me all the time. I have to have this shirt.
Mm-hmm.
That is so me. And they're picturing being the sassy person at the church picnic or the family gathering who's wearing that shirt. Look at Aunt Judy. This is so true. And they get the little like dap from wearing that shirt.
Right.
That's worth the $20 to them. Now, that's not me being like self whatever. I'm saying like that's truly like I've polled people on this, or they come to the table saying this.
Yeah. Well, what they're doing is they want something that reinforces a part of them they want to be true.
Well, everybody wants to be funny. And so when you wear a shirt that makes people laugh and they go, where did you get that? I've been told this my whole life. And then people start ordering it off this website.
Yeah.
Like it's interesting. But it's not really like a jokey joke shirt, like set up punch. It's
right.
Just
it wasn't
this
as
thing.
It wasn't in theory as well crafted as your other shirts.
But it didn't matter. It's about the accessibility is more important, and like the feeling. It's like the whole like what's the Maya Angelou thing that people will forget what you said and did, but they'll never forget how you made them feel.
Yeah,
I think there's a thing that like when you're designing a product or you're trying to think about your own brand or just how you live your life. Yeah, it's like, how are you making people feel? Is there an accessibility to you? Likeability? We talked about likeability a little bit last week, but like this idea of being likable in what I do and maybe even what you do is so important. Like, it's easy for a pastor to be like, I'm just going to tell them the truth and that's all that matters.
Yeah.
But I just don't, if they can't get past your personality to even listen to you because they've decided you're a jerk or you're aggressive and abrasive.
Yeah.
So I do think there's an idea. Now, again, you could go to the other side of the scale and be like, I'm going to say whatever will tickle their ears. Like, I understand that there's that blend.
It's a super, super difficult balance. Because we were having the talk on the staff call this morning about that a little bit. And I made the joke. I was like, well, I spent my life as a people pleaser. And I'm really amazed when I'm now as a speaker or as a pastor, when I'm saying what I think God wants them to hear.
Yeah.
I'm amazed at the idea of how many of them dislike me.
Yeah.
Like I wanted to please them, how displeased they are at times with that. And it is a weird, I said some things last Sunday that I think are important, and I addressed because 2 Thessalonians addressed them. That's the book I was in.
Yeah.
It's literally the entire book is about this sort of obsession, conspiracy, fear-based concept the whole church was wrapped around based upon the second coming of Christ and rumors that it had already happened. And they're saying Paul had said it and Paul had not. And it was just making them afraid. And they also were not focusing on the principles of the gospel that are life-giving. They were focused on, outskirt things. Though the second coming is huge and important, it's just not foundational in terms of us knowing the details of when. And so Paul was, doing all this. So it's like a one-to-one comparison, I feel like, to today in so many areas with the conspiracy mindset and those things. So, I mean, I had to say things like, there was a time in my life I was guaranteed if X happened that we would be under Sharia law. Guaranteed, as prophecy. And that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so my issue is not that someone made the mistake. My issue is there's no repentance or no turning away from that mindset or even from that prophetic voice, quote unquote. Like that the scripture says, okay, we test this. It wasn't right. And now we stop listening to those sources. And those sources, if they're truly in the faith, should have no problem saying, I missed this. And there's a repentance to it, not that leads to shame and condemnation, but a repentance that just says, this is how it works.
Yeah.
We make mistakes. So, but I don't think people like that message.
Right.
Like, I don't think everybody, and some may think, oh, here we go again. John's on his woke soapbox or whatever. I kind of get that impression sometimes.
The woke box.
Yeah.
If you will.
And it's like, so to your point, like, I'm not trying to sell anything anymore. I think there was a day when, I mean, you're going to laugh at this. There was a day where I did organize, and God's Word was preached, but I organized a series or wrote a series around movies.
Yeah.
And that day may come again.
Everybody did that.
You know, God at the box office or whatever.
God at the movies.
Yeah. And it's like this idea that you can, you know, we can find God's truth and all these things. I think it's great. It's very topical.
It's a good excuse to play Tommy Boy clips.
Right.
In your sermon.
And right now, it just feels, I'm not dogging, again, I've done that, you know, but it feels to me like, it would feel like I was not, like, there's a, I forget who the author is, but there's an author who calls it the bleeding neck. And that is like
Agatha Christie.
If you have,
no,
if you're going to try to figure out what needs to be addressed,
yeah,
and let's say you come to a car, you come up on a car accident and someone has broken their ankle,
right?
And someone has, and they've, you know, obviously their wrist is really bruised and all these things, but their neck is bleeding profusely.
Right. You triage.
You immediately go, oh, the bleeding neck is
priorities.
The problem. Yeah. So like when I come right now, the state of affairs in, you know, I mean, my gosh, just the Southern Baptist Convention this last week and all the changes and all the stuff about abuse and race and CRT and all these things, like there's a lot of bleeding necks. And so for me to stand up and just talk about movies feels like I am not triaging this appropriately as a shepherd to say, hey guys, I know, you know, there's a twisted ankle here, but this is an imperative biblical way to think or believe. And unfortunately it's like a lot of people would rather you deal with the ankle, and I don't know. So I just, how that plays into, I do believe the consumerism mindset of ministry has to be extracted at some point. And I'll say it's like watching a science experiment from outside of myself. Watching a people-pleasing guy his entire life not please people. Now, people did walk up and talk to me about it or whatever. You know, it's one of those, man, you said it was a lot of stuff I needed to hear today. It was a true, like it wasn't a, man, that was the best. It was a, that, I know I need that.
Right, it challenged me.
And it's a, and I'm sharing that with you because we actually know each other. As opposed to the smokescreen of compliments that you get sometimes.
Well, I think with humor, that's, there's the balance and there's the other extremes too. Like there's the thing of like, I get to be 100% myself if I want to be. I need likability to really like get what I want to say across. Some of that you can control, some of it you can't control. Because sometimes people walk out and I've just seen their persona and you're like, I'm already rooting for this guy and I don't even know why. It's like intangible. But then there's the idea that like, if I wanted to just do very broad jokes and try to attract a certain audience, I could just do certain material, and I've decided to do like I mix in some challenging things, and I do think humor should offend sometimes too. Like there's a place, there's a time and a place for humor to challenge your idea.
Yeah.
And I think we're losing that in some degree. I'm not going to sound the alarm on political correctness or whatever, or cancel culture, and say like, why can't we say, you know, why can't we talk about immigrants anymore? There's some of these comedians that have been getting by on like, just like debasing transgender people. And they're like, why can't I do that anymore? And you're like, maybe you shouldn't have had that material. Like, I just don't know.
Right.
So I'm not saying that, but I do think that like humor should challenge. Like there's a wave of comics who work in churches like I do, and they're starting to satirize goofy things within the church that we do that we've always just been considered normal.
Yeah.
And there might be people who would be offended at that because they've made that sacred.
Yeah.
And I think there's a place for that kind of joke, like where you go, why do we do this though? Is this really, like I used to have a joke about testaments when I first started about how like, why do we have to have our own breath mints? Yeah. Are certs like evil? Are Tic Tacs of the devil, really? Did we need this? Now, that's not offensive, but it challenges this status quo a little bit.
Right.
And I think there's a place for that. So if I wanted to just be like generic, like, how can I make the most people like me? I'm not going to end up being very funny. But if I want to just be like, I want to say the angriest thing that I'm the most mad about, then I'm going to go to the other side and no one's going to listen because I'm just like screaming.
I think it goes back some to that idea of, you know, there is a chance that your authentic self is not promotable.
Yeah.
Like
I'm very open to that right now.
I don't mean you. I mean, this is the understood you.
Turns
for
out
all of us.
You're unhirable. this is an intervention.
Like if you find yourself having to fundamentally change your entire disposition order to do something in entertainment or ministry, either one.
Yeah.
And then I think there's a problem. Like there, and I've been thinking as you were talking, I was thinking like, where is the line of? I do believe that I'm going to use a term here that's not internal. I rarely use it in this fashion, but the external community or congregation or crowd or whatever you call it, like the audience.
Yeah,
like there is an interaction with them that can tell you a lot about yourself, and I do believe. Like this whole be true to yourself movement basically just gives you a right to be a jerk and to say, don't worry about the consequences of the social consequences that come from that. That's their problem.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
you can't handle me at my worst. You don't deserve me at my best.
And it's kind of like, you know, okay, I do believe the external community. I agree. There's always extremism to everything that can be unhealthy.
Yeah.
But okay. As a speaker, if I want to be effective, then I do have to at least be mindful of what won't cause the audience to entirely shut down. The flip side of that is if I only think of the audience in terms of sales or in terms of growth, so sales for entertainment, growth for ministry, if I only see them as that, then I'm already in a disingenuous place. Now, if I'm just an entertainer, it may not matter. Because
I think that eventually it does matter because people see through it.
Well, again, the worst stories in the world, you were talking about how people interact, and I was speaking with a comedian about that this last week, like how people, what they buy at your table or what they do at your show is a form of collaboration with you.
Yeah.
You know, that's the highest honor. I want to be a part of this with you, and if I can, add something to it. And somebody, and he'll laugh because he listens to the podcast, somebody came to me and they had pitched you a joke the other day. You know,
and they
came to me apologizing, like, "Hey, you know, that's your friend, and I may not know him well enough." I said, "That's all people do to Johnny."
Oh, I don't care.
And it's the highest honor.
I don't remember what it was.
I don't remember what it was either. But I was like, he's not offended by that.
No.
That means
sometimes you get good stuff. It's like a good premise at least.
And you've engaged though.
Yeah, yeah.
You're saying, "I like this so much. I want to be a part of it."
Yeah.
That's not offensive. Whether he uses it or not, I said, I pitch stuff to Johnny all the time he never uses. And then I was super bitter for a long time in the conversation. No. But I do think, like, where is the line to say I am learning something from this audience without, and that might, let's use these terms now, my true self or my authentic self should also be growing. Mm-hmm. I think we assume that your authentic self is stationary and static. Like, well, I'm just going to be who I am. Well, in Christ, who I am is established and also should be, and there's a great word, maturing. Like, I should be growing in maturity even though the essence of who I am is established. I should not be the same authentic self at 45 as I was at 25. I should know more about my motivations or how I, you know, why I respond as I do. But, you know, and I may be more forthright in some areas of life out of being more authentic, more willing to not be liked.
Right.
That's great. But it doesn't mean, though, that I should just take everything I've ever wanted and just shut everybody out and say, nope, nope, this is me, and not allow room to grow through those things.
Well, even like as I write, because now what I write from is just like my own fears and experiences and my own ideas. I write to learn how I feel about something. Yeah. And so, you learn about yourself. And I got to tell you, it's gross in here. So that's the thing. You go, is this something I feel? Is this something I want to say on stage? Now it's like, that's the stuff that makes it fun though. You know, I did a joke about, at Zany's this past week that I've been wanting to do for like 4 years, and I've done it like four times, and I was trying to figure out how to tell it. And it was like it's a true story about health class and how the premise of it is how boys growing up, there's a lot of pressure on us to feel like we know everything there is to know about like sex and our bodies. And there's this pressure like, I know. And you don't know anything. And you're hoping, what you're really hoping is someone will either tell you, you fake it till you make it. You hope that someone in health class asks the question.
Yes.
That you desperately want to know the answer to.
And you'll just sit there cool as a cucumber like
that. And you get to know now.
Yeah.
And so seventh grade, the health class heroes, that's what I call them. They're health class heroes. There was a kid named Chad. He raises his hand sheepishly as Mr. Trawick is going over the anatomy chart. He gets to the ovaries, and Chad goes, "Mr. Trawick, where are my ovaries?" And Mr. Trawick said, "Son, you don't have ovaries." And so a lot of us laughed, and then some of us were like, "What happened to Chad's ovaries?" And how does Mr. Trawick know? And so that's like a story that I've wanted to tell forever, and I never knew that, that all that really happened.
Wow.
And I've kind of extrapolated like this bit from it, but it's like I didn't know how to tell it. It's this super kind of embarrassing, because you have to reveal about yourself something embarrassing. It's not just like, oh, Chad's an idiot. Yeah. You're admitting, like, how can I find this common ground with the audience that we all felt clueless about our bodies when we're that age? And yet somebody fell on the grenade for us. How can I?
Yeah.
So it's that, that adventure of trying to tell that joke for 4 years now. Like, that's why I do what I do, and I love it so much. But again, to get there, I have to give a part of myself to the audience and hope, are we on the same page? It's like you say when you go, well, I don't know if everybody feels the same way that you do about blah, blah, blah. And then I'm like, that's the fear of like, what if I'm the only one that's experiencing this? And you're just like, nope, just you, weirdo.
Yeah. I do have that fear. It's a shame more than it is a fear. Like, it's a, oh, I must be the only one who doesn't get something.
Yeah. Which is funny because everybody feels that.
Right.
And when you get the laugh, that's everyone going, me too.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had this.
Why such a great feeling?
Yeah.
It's like a big agreement, a big amen.
You acknowledged collective vulnerability.
Yeah.
And then you neutralized it.
Yeah.
Or you validated it in a way that they could feel relief. I still look back, and it's so funny, you know, the Enneagram book I'm working on. When I look back, they talk a lot about your core, like, what's your first childhood memory? What's your, you know, those, go to those core memories on some things.
Yeah.
And, man, you and I say this. I could make my stomach churn if I went to certain memories.
Yes.
Still.
I make, like, an audible sound sometimes when I think of something. The fly, you walk out with your fly down in sixth grade. I go, oh, I just remember it. And it, yeah, it's
like, there's a funny, it's a gross story, but I tell Sadie this story when I'm in, and she actually likes it because it's, she understands, like, hey, this is about humility and sowing and reaping. Like, I'm telling you everything you do as a direct, you know.
Yeah.
But if you sow kindness, generally kindness comes back. And if you don't, it does not. I was like, I remember being in fourth grade and I was in the bathroom. All the boys were going to the bathroom. And, like, I laughed or did something, and, like, snot just came right out of my nose.
Oh, wow.
And this boy, and this is such a, like, core memory for me.
Uh-huh.
It taught me something about life. This boy just, like, in the bathroom, just me and the boys, you know, just laughed and made me, and I felt dumb and stupid, you know. Same day, Johnny, same day, we're back in the classroom with all the girls and everybody. And something happens where he sneezes, and the same thing happens to him, except exposed to everybody. And I remember thinking, he laughed at me, and then it came back worse for him.
He was smitten.
Yeah, I was like,
he got smote.
I don't remember. like connecting it directly to God bringing snot out of the boy's nose.
If I know anything about young John Driver, you 100% did. You went home and said, thus saith.
That's what, touch
you
not
have
my...
set a table for me in the presence of mine enemies.
Touch not my anointed. Yeah.
Touch snot mine anointed.
If you don't write, if this episode's not called Touch Not My Anointed.
It's got to be.
I can't. Guys, I'm going to have to push pause and come back. That tickled me so bad. But, you know, you just have that memory of, like, embarrassed. And, of course, I think embarrassment sticks with you more than anything. At least it does for me. I don't want to be embarrassed. And I think it's still to this day. You know, it's revealed, again, in all your different Enneagram types. Anyone feels that.
Yeah.
You know, for someone, it's like, I don't want to be found being, I guess, rejected.
Yeah.
Very similar thing. I don't want to be found, you know, being targeted, blamed, or laughed at. Someone else, that same sort of desire, the core desire of all humanity to belong, you know, to have a place where you're okay. And that like, thing that's broken in us, in all humans. I was listening to Switchfoot. John Foreman says, you know, he's writing about we're amateur lovers and amateur friends. Remember that song?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he says, my baby and me, we have the same, what is it? We're missing the same thing is the gist of it. Like this deficiency of love, but we can't get it through dating or relationships or sex, or like we can't. So we don't know what we're doing, but we're, let's do it again. That's his whole tagline. We're amateur lovers, amateur mm-hmm. friends. Like, there's this thing that's not being satisfied by all the things that we're seeking after, whether it's fame or whether it's relationships, but it's all relationships. Why do I want fame at the base desire of it? I want to be known by as many people as possible in a positive way. Mm-hmm. So why do I want to be rich? You know, alone, it's probably not going to work. I want people to think well of me, that I'm successful, and that I want to be able to provide for myself and them in a way that I don't have to worry. So it all comes back to, I need to be known by somebody. You know, I'm trying to know myself to go there. So I just think it's just this journey of, I am collaborating with everyone around me in some way, whether I realize it or not, and I have to figure out what authenticity really looks like. And that's why, you know, there is a freedom, and I'll end that whole diatribe with this. Preaching to not please people is a different freeing experience.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to offend. I don't mind if the gospel does. And if I do, I don't mind apologizing for that. I'm not trying to distract away by being the opposite of that. But instead of being true to myself, I'm trying to be true to the gospel. Mm-hmm. And in that, I just realized how long of my life. It's not that I was ever trying to not be true to the gospel, but to say, no, above myself,
yeah,
I'm going to do this, and you might not like me, and that's
what. Well, I'm glad you opened the door for that, because I've been wanting to tell you this for a while.
I don't like you. But listener, we hope that you've liked the time that we've had today.
Mm.
These segues.
You can find all our archived episodes on talkaboutthatpodcast.com. Go to our Patreon, kick in a few shekels if you feel led. Mm.
If you don't, maybe.
Hey, we're leading you now.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay to be led.
Yeah. I'm leading you right now to the fact that that would be a great thing.
We're not
for
trying
you
to over-spiritualize it. Just do it.
Yeah.
We need your help.
Just end from Jesus. He said you should just do this.
As humans, we're asking you, with no real spiritual oomph behind it, yeah, hey, it helps us make things.
Yeah.
So, anyway, if you want to do that, that's great. If not, we understand it's tight for some folks. That's good, too. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it.
Yeah. That was very nice, Johnny.
Yeah.
I felt that you acknowledged the place where everybody was.
It's a new tack for me, because it's manipulative is what it is. I'm trying to be humble in the hopes that they'll be like, what a humble guy. And then the wallets fly open.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know.
Turn in your wallet to page 20.
We'll see if it works. Yeah.
Hey, guys, seriously, share it. Give us some good reviews. Get a friend to listen. And we continue the process of growing here through episode 163, I believe, Johnny. So that's a lot. It's a lot. So. But we'll have another one for you next week here on
Talk About That.
And oftentimes, you know, you're chasing happiness, but you don't know that God is the best way to achieve the happiness you're looking for. And so I was trying to end my suffering by sinning, but I only ended up sinning my way into more suffering.
That was Grammy winner Lecrae unpacking his testimony on The Walk, a podcast for worshipers. Join us weekly to hear artists, songwriters, worship leaders, filmmakers, and other creatives tell stories in the form of a devotional. The Walk can be found on lifeaudio.com or your favorite podcast platform.